Welcome to the Shortwave Report for January 20th, 2012. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite simple. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past four shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from China Radio International, NHK World Radio Japan, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, The Voice of Russia, and Radio Havana Cuba. We'll begin with China Radio International. China commemorated the 40th anniversary of Nixon's visit, so Henry Kissinger was on hand. Kissinger is helping increase communication on partnership between the U.S. and China. Iran's foreign minister wants to start up nuclear talks with other world leaders. China Radio International.
Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping now says that China is willing to work with the United States to push forward their cooperative partnership. Xi Jinping has made the comments at a ceremony in Beijing, marking the 40th anniversary of former U.S. President Richard Nixon's historic visit to China. Meantime, former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who was critical in spearheading Nixon's trip here to China back in 1972, was also in attendance. He says the prospect of Sino-U.S. ties unlikely to change much, though he does note that there will be some commotion this year amid the presidential elections in the United States.
As one of the most seasoned U.S. experts on China, 89-year-old Dr. Henry Kissinger said he's optimistic about the relationship. Although the two countries are competitors in some economic fields, and that there are worries about China's economic power in the U.S., considering the magnitude of the interaction between the two sides, Dr. Kissinger said the relationship is going along quite well. When commenting about criticism inside the States on letting China become the largest debt owner, Dr. Kissinger said this is not a major view.
Most Americans think that our democratic system is the system that should exist all over the world. And so it's possible that some people say, why are we borrowing from a communist country? But the money we borrow is helping us. So there are undoubtedly people who say this. It's not the dominant trend.
Dr. Kissinger emphasized that it's inevitable that difference will remain as the countries have totally different social backgrounds. The difference will make interaction complicated sometimes, but on the whole, good practices have been made. Both sides have learned to live with difference and work together to avoid a zero-sum game.
A conflict between China and the United States would weaken both societies and would weaken the prospects of progress and peace in the world. If you look at the world today and you ask yourself, what possible benefit could it, such a conflict bring to either people? And how would you know which side has won? And what would the so-called victor ask of the other? You realize that we can only exhaust ourselves by conflict, and that it's the guiding principle of the foreign policy.
Dr. Kissinger is scheduled to attend the third round of China-U.S. Track 2 high-level dialogue in Beijing this week. The high-level dialogue between China and the U.S. was inaugurated in 2009 and participated by retired eminent diplomats and officials from both countries. Former State Councilor Tang Jiaxuan will lead the Chinese side in the talk. For CRI, I'm Chen Chengguan.
Iran's Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Salehi says Tehran is ready for nuclear talks with the world's major powers despite the recent assassination of an Iranian nuclear scientist. Iran has accused the United States, Britain, and Israel of last week's assassination of Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan in Tehran. Nuclear talks between Iran and the G5 plus one countries failed to reach any agreement last year.
Those reports were from China Radio International, heard from 4 to 5 p.m. at 11970, and from 6 p.m. to 11 at either 9790, 6020, or 6190, or on the web at english.cri.cn. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Standard Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. The United States is facing difficulties getting other countries to cease buying oil from Tehran. The Nuclear Crisis Minister of Japan is stepping up efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. A demonstration was held at the oldest nuclear power plant in France. The members of Sea Shepherd continue obstructing Japanese whaling vessels in the Antarctic. NHK Japan.
The United States is facing difficulties in its attempt to get other countries to support sanctions against Iran in a move to force it to halt its nuclear development. The U.S. Energy Department says Iran produced 4.25 million barrels of crude oil a day in 2010, making it the world's fifth largest producer. The department says data from the first half of last year shows China imported 22% of Iran's oil, the largest importer in the world. The European Union imported 18%, followed by Japan at 14%, India at 13%, South Korea at 10%, and Turkey at 7%. South Korea says it will support the U.S. policy while taking into consideration the impact the sanctions would have on the country's economy. The EU will decide at a foreign ministerial meeting next Monday to ban Iranian oil imports. China is opposed to sanctions, which it says will not resolve the Iranian nuclear issue. It also says it needs Iran's oil for continued economic growth. India says it will continue importing oil from Iran. Turkey has also said it will not support the U.S. sanctions. Turkey gets more than half of its oil imports from Iran.
Nuclear Crisis Minister Goshi Hosono has pledged to enhance the international effort to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. Hosono spoke to reporters on Saturday after he visited Japan Atomic Energy Agency facilities in Tokai Village in Ibaraki Prefecture. At one of the facilities he visited, researchers analyzed tiny samples collected during international inspections to check if the materials are only being used for peaceful purposes. After the visit, Hosono told reporters that concern over nuclear proliferation is increasing this year with developments in North Korea and Iran. Hosono said Japan is proud to be an exemplary country that addresses the non-proliferation effort, working with the International Atomic Energy Agency. Hosono also said non-proliferation will be an important theme for the new Nuclear Safety Agency to be launched in April. His remarks are taken as indicating that Japan will do more in the effort for non-proliferation with a major role to be played by the forthcoming agency.
A demonstration was held on Sunday near France's oldest nuclear power plant, demanding the immediate shutdown of the facility. About 300 people gathered for the rally in the eastern French town of Fessenheim near the German and Swiss borders. Some of the activists were from Germany and Switzerland. The plant started operation 34 years ago. Protesters held up banners and signs saying an accident like the one at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant should never happen again and that the Fessenheim plant is getting too old. They called for the power station to be shut down immediately. France's nuclear authorities are asking the power company that operates the plant to reinforce the structure of the reactor. How to ensure the safety of aging nuclear plants is one of the major issues in the French presidential election in April. President Nicolas Sarkozy is being cautious about closing the Fessenheim plant, while his main challenger, François Hollande of the Socialist Party, is calling for its immediate shutdown.
Members of the anti-whaling group Sea Shepherd have obstructed a Japanese whaling ship in the Antarctic Ocean by throwing paint bottles and using knives to cut nets. The Japanese Fisheries Agency says Sea Shepherd members approached the Yushin Maru No. 2 by boat on early Wednesday. Members of the group threw about 30 bottles filled with paint at the ship. The agency says the activists pulled alongside the Japanese vessel and used knives to cut nets that had been put in place to prevent harassment. The crew of the whaling ship tried to repel the assault by spraying water and fending off Sea Shepherd members with a bamboo pole. No crew members were injured in the two-hour-long incident. The Fisheries Agency condemned Sea Shepherd's actions, saying the use of knives endangered the lives of the Japanese ship's crew. Sea Shepherd claims that three of its members were injured by the bamboo pole and by ropes with grappling hooks that were thrown from the Japanese vessel.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 9 to 9:30 p.m. at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Standard Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Labor unions in Nigeria called off the national strike after fuel prices were lowered. Germany has had so-called anti-terror laws in effect for 10 years. Here is a discussion of their effect on terror and society. Radio Deutsche Welle.
In Nigeria, labor unions have called off a national strike after President Goodluck Jonathan agreed to partially restore fuel subsidies. The unions claimed victory, but also said they had taken the decision to save lives after learning that security forces had been authorized to use all necessary means to end protests. The wave of strikes and demonstrations began a week ago after the president revoked fuel subsidies, causing the fuel price to more than double. Under the partial restoration of the subsidies, the price of fuel will remain well above the previous level.
Here in Germany, it has now been 10 years since a comprehensive anti-terror law came into effect, passed in the wake of the September 11th attacks, which were in part planned by students at a technical university in Hamburg. The law broadened the government's power to watch over German residents in an effort to keep future terror plots from coming to fruition. But the law is not without its critics. They say it has led to widespread state surveillance and has done little to make the country safer. Earlier, I spoke to Philip Holtmann, a Berlin-based analyst of online jihadist networks, and asked him what parts of the law had had the most impact.
Well, I think that the key provisions of this law, such as information on bank accounts, on communication, on the way people travel, biometric information on people's passports, all this cluster of elements and provisions inside this law mean that the state has the possibility to get to know and obtain information on its citizens in a much more, let's say, intrusive way than it did before. So it's a double-edged sword, and of course the state wants to fight terrorism. On the other hand, it's not really clear if this is going to be the solution.
Well, the justification for laws like this is that they might foil future attacks. Are there some specific situations in which we can say that this law has saved lives?
The Silent Cell in 2007 was caught, detected, and brought to trial. It meant that a major terrorism plot in Germany was foiled. However, the question is if this operation, this counter-terrorist operation against the Silent Cell, wouldn't have been possible even without the anti-terrorism law of 2002. I think that the way anti-terrorism laws have been stipulated and have been brought up since 2002 are not really creative and not really effective in foreign terrorism plots.
If in that we've now had 10 years to assess both the German anti-terror law and a little bit longer to assess things like the U.S. Patriot Act, are these laws really doing the job? Are they fighting terror?
So I think absolutely not. The war against terrorism over the last 10 years has basically been a war for terrorism on which the military-industrial complex internationally has profited. Hundreds of thousands of people, including me, being involved in analysis on terrorism and international security agendas. But actually what has happened over the last 10 years is that these anti-terrorism laws and policies have created more terrorists. It has led to the rise of the phenomenon of international terrorism exponentially over the last 10 years. Yeah? And that's conceptually a point, I think, which is very important to make. And if we want to fight terrorism, we are certainly not going to do it by new anti-terrorism laws, okay?
Well, Germany has some specific circumstances when it comes to these issues. A couple of times in the last century, it experienced governments that surveilled on citizens, that used violence against its own citizens. So some of these issues about state power are particularly big in Germany. Has the government taken that into account when crafting these laws?
Yes, that's absolutely right. These sensitivities are existent, and government has sometimes over the last years, especially in terms of the fight against terrorism, closed both eyes when it comes to, well, preventing the raise of power at the hands of security services and the way security services are able to deal with information. If, for example, if we look at the combined terrorism centers in Berlin, which have been set up since 2004 to fight terrorism on the home front and also on the internet, then we see that there a cooperation takes place between different federal agencies, which has not been justified by law. However, there's agencies and they say that they merely cooperate and do not collaborate, and as long as they don't collaborate, they don't need to be set up or justified or legitimized by law, by the German state, or by a special provision that is there to legitimize the federal cooperation of agencies, which, by matter of law, should work separately, should not sit under one roof. So I think a couple of examples illustrate that the state has not really dealt well with its responsibility to prevent a clustering of power at the hands of the security agencies and institutions.
That was Philipp Holtmann, a scholar at the University of Vienna's Jihadism Online project.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, mediacenter.dw-world.de. Next, the voice of Russia. The Russian Foreign Ministry says that the new U.S. National Defense Act could have negative consequences and contradicts international law. The voice of Russia.
The Russian Foreign Ministry said on its website on Sunday that the new U.S. security law, which allows the military to detain American terrorist suspects without trial, could have negative consequences and is, in fact, contradictory to international law. According to the ministry, the new $662 billion National Defense Act strengthens the application of U.S. criminal and anti-terrorism legislation in respect of non-American citizens and violates U.S. obligations under international law, including the Geneva Convention on the Protection of Civilians and the 1966 Covenant on Civil and Political Rights.
President Barack Obama signed the bill into law last year on December 31st. The act contains provisions regulating the detention, interrogation, and prosecution of suspected terrorists, including sanctions requiring suspected members of Al-Qaeda to be kept in military custody. The Russian Foreign Ministry said in the statement, "On the whole, the law formulations are quite vague. The law contributes to a wider extraterritorial use of American criminal and anti-terrorist legislation in relation to citizens of third-party countries."
The document further added that by expanding the powers of the U.S. military as stipulated in the new security law, Washington breaches its obligations under the 1966 International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights relating to the ban on the illegitimate deprivation of liberty, tortures, and cruel treatment of imprisoned persons, and also linked with the provision of fair justice.
The Russian Foreign Ministry pointed out that human rights lawyers had been criticizing the bill since its conception. It further expressed its concern about the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, saying, "Legal tricks and excuses by the president do not remove the problem of extrajudicial detention at the facility." For over a year now, U.S. allies have refused to accept former Guantanamo detainees in their countries, citing a lack of progress in closing the prison.
It's not just the Russian Foreign Ministry who finds the changes in U.S. defense law a source of serious concern. Many inside the U.S. agree that individual rights of Americans have been drastically eroded. The Washington Post wrote on Saturday that U.S. law and practice of that law suggests that America may not be as free of a land as many of its citizens would like to believe, citing the December National Defense Authorization Act as a prime example.
In fact, the paper found 10 more reasons why the U.S. may no longer be a free country. First is the fact that the U.S. has started to assassinate its own citizens, as it did with Anwar al-Awlaki and another terrorist suspect. The U.S. president can now give orders to kill anyone whom he considers to be allied with terrorists, although the U.S. has consistently criticized other nations with similar practices.
Then there is indefinite detention of citizens accused of terrorism, which was also signed into law last month. According to the Post, U.S. justice is now arbitrary, with the president deciding whether a person will receive a trial in the federal courts or in a military tribunal, a system that has been ridiculed around the world for lacking basic due process protections.
There are also warrantless searches that can now be conducted upon the discretion of the president. The law also includes a provision which would force companies and organizations to turn over information on citizens' finances, communications, and associations.
The frequent use of secret evidence by the government to detain individuals and try them in military and federal courts is cited as another reason why Americans may now be less free than ever. The same law allows the U.S. government to dismiss any case against the U.S. by simply filing declarations that the cases would make the government reveal classified information that would harm national security.
The Obama administration stipulated in 2009 that war crimes such as waterboarding terrorist suspects committed by CIA employees would go unpunished. The U.S. also resisted attempts by foreign countries to investigate war crimes committed by Americans. Such an approach goes against Nuremberg principles of international law and the Geneva Conventions.
The U.S. government has stepped up the use of the Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which can now deal with individuals deemed to be aiding or abetting hostile foreign governments or organizations. At the same time, the government also granted immunity to companies that assist in the warrantless surveillance of citizens. The government will also continue to be allowed to use GPS devices to monitor the movements of citizens that are being targeted.
Finally, there is extraordinary rendition, a practice that allows the transfer of both citizens and non-citizens to another country, such as Syria, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Pakistan, for torture. The paper likens the formerly democratic America to authoritarian states such as Cuba and Saudi Arabia.
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 10 at 12030, 13665, 9840, or 7250, or through their website, www.english.ruvr.ru. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. I'm grateful for any donations to help support this program. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Russia warned that a Western military attack on Iran would be a catastrophe. Hugo Chavez and Vladimir Putin agree that the sovereignty of Syria and Iran should be defended against any foreign interference. The United Nations has called for emergency aid to the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Foreign Policy magazine reported that Israeli Mossad agents have posed as U.S. spies to carry out covert operations in Pakistan. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Russia's foreign minister has warned that a Western military strike against Iran would be a catastrophe. Sergei Lavrov said an attack would lead to large flows of refugees from Iran and would fan the flames of sectarian tension in the Middle East. The comments from the Russian foreign minister included criticism of Western moves to tighten sanctions on the Islamic Republic, which he said were aimed at stifling Iran's economy. Lavrov told journalists in Moscow that they would have to ask those who he said were talking constantly about a military attack to find out if it would occur. He said such an attack would start a chain reaction, and he didn't know how that would end. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak said that any decision on an Israeli attack on Iran was, in his words, very far off. Israel is the only nuclear power in the region, and has said it would strike Iran to prevent it from developing nuclear weapons. Iran has blamed Israel and the United States for the death of Mostafa al-Mahdi Rosan, a nuclear scientist who was killed by a bomb targeting his car in the Iranian capital last week. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister said that talks on his country's nuclear program will probably take place in Istanbul. Ali Akbar Saleh told reporters during a visit to Turkey that negotiations were going on about the venue and date, adding that the timing would be settled soon.
During a recent telephone conversation, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin agreed that the sovereignty of Syria and Iran should be defended against foreign interference and from the siege of colonial powers. A statement issued by Venezuela's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the two leaders also agreed on the need to craft a common approach to defend the independence and sovereignty of the Syrian Arab Republic and the Islamic Republic of Iran against the harassment and interference of foreign powers. While Chavez has openly expressed support for embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Moscow has repeatedly rejected any foreign intervention and the use of force against Syria, as happened in Libya, and announced that it will oppose any UN resolution that includes sanctions against the regime. In related news, President Hugo Chavez has criticized the U.S. State Department's absurd decision to threaten Latin American countries with sanctions should they engage in trade with Iran. Chavez's comments followed a State Department briefing last week in which the agency spokesperson, Victoria Nuland, warned Latin American countries that they could suffer U.S. sanctions if they were to use Iranian banks or purchase Iranian oil. Addressing viewers on state television channel VTV, Chavez criticized Nuland's statements and cited them as proof of continued U.S. neocolonialism in the region.
The United Nations has called for emergency aid amounting to $300 million for the Gaza Strip and West Bank in order to counteract the situation of Palestinians in the occupied territories. The call was issued by the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East. The Deputy Commissioner of the agency, Margot Ellis, told reporters at UN headquarters that the Gaza Strip remains under a blockade by Israel, and Palestinians are subject to collective punishment deemed illegal under international law. Margot said that the requested $300 million will go towards food security, protection of the population, health, water, education, and housing. Foreign Policy magazine, published in the United States, is reporting Israeli Mossad agents have posed as U.S. spies to recruit members of the Pakistani militant group Jundala in carrying out covert operations against Iran. According to the report, the CIA learned about the so-called false flag operation several years ago. It is unclear if the program continues. The magazine report was published in Washington just days after Iran accused Israel of assassinating one of its nuclear scientists.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 2 p.m. to 3 at 11760 and from 4 p.m. to 11 at either 6060, 6010, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 4 to 11 p.m. at www.radiohc.cu and now podcasting at World Radio Network, which is wrn.org. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Standard Time. Please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcast using a shortwave radio at home, which is pretty simple. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.